trumpet player Charlie Porter is from Florida and studied trumpet at the Alexander W. Dreyfus School of the Arts, and he holds degrees from the Juilliard School and Manhattan School of Music in jazz and classical performance, and was a Fulbright Scholar at the Paris Conservatory. He won a Grammy Award in 2020 for his collaboration on the album Song Play by Joyce DiDonato. Charlie has released three critically acclaimed albums as a leader. His third album, Hindsight, thoughtfully and astutely addresses how we act in hindsight to deal with the collateral damage of progress and the centuries-old struggles with racism, inequality, and corruption. Also, he has a dope idea for his next project entitled Cypher. Mr. Porter, thank you so much for being on The Sauce today with me.
Oh, thank you, Don. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. I'm really excited about your album and the music that you have been playing and how you've been representing that music and speaking about it. And you have a really interesting upbringing that starts with where you were born in Florida. Can you tell me about your early days of your life?
Sure. I was born in Boynton Beach, Florida, and basically lived most of my days until the age of 18 in the greater West Palm Beach area and Lake Worth. And yeah, so I was a typical kind of beach kid, although I sunburned way too easily for someone that lived in Florida.
right. So, and then you went to Juilliard.
Yeah, my grandmother was a pivotal force in getting me into music, and she kind of introduced me to jazz and to a lot of other types of music, mostly jazz and classical. Took me to my first concert where I got to see Wynton Marsalis perform live. I was 13 years old. And from that moment on, she kind of, you know, she directed me to audition for the art school down in West Palm Beach. And so I did that. She also, I remember her giving me this clipping, newspaper clipping about the Juilliard School and saying, oh, this is where Wynton went, you know? And so I had that in my brain from a very early age that I wanted to go to Juilliard if at all possible. And also knowing that Wynton lived in New York, and in fact, just a few feet away from the Juilliard School at the time, that was a prime target on my brain.
That's really quite remarkable, actually, when you think about it, because he wound up being a mentor to you. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, really, from the age of 13, that was, you know, and this is a typical story you hear from a lot of people that meet Wynton when they're young kids backstage. It's amazing the effect that he's had on so many people. So my story isn't that unique, but I was backstage and he immediately helped me, you know, with an embouchure change, took me over to the mirror, you know, gave me his $60,000 trumpet and said, yeah, why don't you warm up for me and play something for me. So, and that's what led to kind of a longer relationship of me basically checking in with him every time he would come back into town. Mm. And so I would get to then ask him some more questions. And eventually, when I did make it into Juilliard, then I was able to kind of get some more formal lessons with him. But they still weren't actually through the school. They were just more at his house. And sometimes a lesson would be an hour. Sometimes it would be 5 minutes. Sometimes it would be 3 hours, you know. So it was always a really beautiful experience having those lessons. So.
Absolutely. I mean, it's life changing, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah,
it's like you're never the same when you leave those experiences.
And his teaching is always more conceptual than lessons that I've had with other teachers. You know, it's not just about learning something out of a book. It's about learning a concept that helps you to understand everything else better, including things that are non-music related. So
what would be an example of that?
Well, I remember one time he was trying to teach me how to take a better breath. And instead of doing what most teachers would do and say, okay, you know, this is how you take a breath, he basically said, what's the most important part of painting a house? And so my response to that was, you know, like the brushes, the paint, I don't know. And so he said to me, and I made a bunch of guesses, and he said, the most important part of painting a house is seeing it in your mind's eye first, experiencing the finished product in your mind before it's done. Sorry about the noise. Is that going to be bad for the?
I think it's beautiful. I love it. Okay. I know that this is that your son, Ellis?
Yeah, my partner, Tessa, and Ellis just came through the door. So, and Ellis is he's a little 7-month-old baby. And yeah, so that's a new thing this year as well.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I love it. And he's named after Ellis Marcellus, I read.
Yeah, so it's, but to finish the thought, the idea was that having that foresight of the house being done ahead of time is what informs you of what color it's going to be, what texture, who you're going to hire to do it. Like, it tells you so many things that you have the vision ahead of time of what it should look like. And so his idea was that when you take a breath, that the breath is actually the foresight of the sound that you want to have. It is the reflection ahead of time of the sound. And so that what he taught me with that was that when you take a breath, the breath should be in the same timing. It should have the same quality of tone as the sound. So if you take a breath like this and you're all tense, you're most likely going to get a tense sound that comes out, right? If you take a nice relaxed breath, that is the sound ahead of time. So it's a really interesting thing. And it can apply to other things too. Oftentimes we're trying to figure out how to do something, but we don't really envision it first fully in our brain before we go to do it. And if you do that, you already have a whole set of instructions that are lining up, showing you how to do it, just based on better foresight.
Just heard an excerpt from In Short Supply by Charlie Porter. This is The Sauce. I'm Dawn Burns.
And going viral is a great vibe. I almost felt like it's a little ironic because it's just it's like, you know, I want that on my playlist when I'm driving along the coast.
Yeah, well, that's
right? It's beautiful.
And I think that's exactly though how viruses work though. They spread, you know, they're catchy in a different way. And sometimes as they're spreading, you don't even notice it. And so this melody, it's kind of infectious and repetitive. But down below, there's kind of this underpinning of these I call them devious bass notes. They might not sound that devious, but compared to the melody, which just goes. It just does that. And it's, you know, sorry, I'm sitting on my piano.
I love that. That's beautiful.
In fact, I came up with it here, believe it or not. It was almost kind of almost a joke. I was hanging out with friends and I got down on the piano. And I was just going, talking about the COVID, the COVID times. And I had this little melody. And then that's where it started, honestly. And then I figured out what the bass line would be. And it was just kind of fun to put that one together.
Now, I know that I think it was 2019, you received a Grammy Award for a project that you did with Joyce DiDonato on her album called Song Play. And that's a very fascinating project that you were speaking about a little bit. And I would love to hear you tell us about how that fusion idea and vision that she had made her album so unique that it won her a Grammy, won you all a Grammy, actually.
Yeah, it's nice to have that little trophy. it happened through connection. Chuck Israels was playing bass on it, and I was playing with his group here in Portland, where I'm currently living. And somebody, a producer for the album, knew Chuck and was putting together a band. So I had never actually met Joyce before that, but Joyce trusted this producer. And so the band was put together, and we were all flown out to California. And I had no idea exactly what was happening. I was like, what, a opera singer? And I'm going to play jazz trumpet on it, but I might also do some classical stuff. What's going on? So, but I'm always up for anything. So we went into the studio just having basically the melodies to work with, and we had to figure out kind of on the spot, oh, I'll do this. Oh, okay, you do that. We'll arrange it here. Let's play the chords like that. Okay, do a counter melody there. Why don't you just play a solo here? Let's do a solo there. And so it just came together really kind of organically like that. And I really love a lot of the album. I think there's some interesting things in there that kind of harken back even to how Duke Ellington used to use soprano in some of his jazz pieces. There was, I think, one of the names of one of the pieces. I can't remember the name. It's a Native American name, and it's subtitled The Beautiful Indians or something. Sorry, Duke. But anyway, it's this beautiful song. And I remember it's got the vocals singing on top of it in a very classical quality on top of these Duke Ellington, quote unquote, you know, jazzy chords, right? Mm-hmm. So that sound has always been a really beautiful sound in my mind. And so I was happy to hear that she was preserving some of her classical sound over the ensemble of jazz musicians. Because right. It's one thing if you just change a classical piece and make it jazzy, but it's really special when both musics can retain a core quality so that when you put them together, they actually create a fusion that's respectful to both, right? And I feel like a large portion of the album was really right on point with that. And I think that's probably what resonated with some of the people that were listening to it and, you know, judging with the Grammys, so.
Right, right. And even in your song, Hindsight, the title track from the album, it really does personify the feeling of hindsight and the sort of balance that comes, you know, through it. It's just very reflective song. So I think it's appropriately titled. And I think really the element of hope really shines in that particular tune on the album.
Thanks. Yeah. It's I wanted to have some kind of reflective atmosphere on that song for it to not really go anywhere specifically, but to have to almost kind of give you space as you're listening to it to have your own thoughts.
Yeah.
I feel like you really took that and carried it through to your next two projects, because then soon after you recorded Immigration Nation, and you were addressing, well, I know, I see in the album description, it talks about uniting power of the word immigrant through art, knowing its healing capacity can be great when crafted with intention. And I love the way that was expressed. Tell me about how it was, what it was like to create that album, Immigration Nation, and it's
sure.
So timely.
I hadn't really, you know, as it has happened with my last three albums, I don't necessarily think about what the album's going to be ahead of time. It just happens to be the music that I'm writing at the moment. And then as that music starts to come together and I have more than, say, three or four or five pieces, if they all start to have a common theme to them, and it's apparent to me that I am writing an album about this subject and I didn't even know it, then I kind of go full force with that. And for this album, I had already written a couple of the songs, but when I wrote the Immigration Nation song, the title track, then it really became clear to me that that was going to be the title track, in fact, of the album, and I was going to call it Immigration Nation. And the impetus for all this for me was all of the negative press that was going on in the news about immigrants, you know, especially with Trump talking about the wall and everything. I felt like immigration, even the name immigrant, was just getting such a bad rap, and that we needed to just remember that the large majority of us, unless you were Native American or unless you were brought over here forcibly through slave trades, were immigrants, you know, and that it we're ancestors of those immigrants. And some of us are, you know, your father might be, or you, you know, might be coming over now trying to be an immigrant. But I think a lot of people that have reached that point of being a third or fourth generation, they just feel a kind of a, oh, I belong here. You know, of course I'm, you know, so, and I just want to make sure that that common bond and that thread of understanding that we're kind of all in this together, and that it's actually something to be proud of and to celebrate, you know, this, the fact that we can come from so many places, and that this, I don't like to call it a melting pot. You know, people call the United States a melting pot. I think of it as a mosaic. Mm. And a mosaic is better because it preserves the little colors and the little shapes of the individual pieces. And I think that that is the best America that I could imagine, right? Mm. United mm-hmm. States. And that was kind of the point of this album, is to show that it's a word to celebrate, and we should extend with open arms to people that want to be part of that.
Now let's look to the future. You're heading to Qatar, you said, with your quintet soon, and you have,
yeah.
And you're going into the studio again.
Yeah. So, there's a local group out here that I play with a lot. Some musicians, George Colligan on piano and Alan Jones on bass, and we call him Sticky, John Lakey, bass, Alan Jones on drums, and John Lakey on bass. And we're going to be recording an album, which is separate from the trip to Qatar. That's going to be with a New York band. But that album, it's a really exciting album called Cypher, in which I don't know if you know what a cypher is, but maybe some of the audience doesn't know. And that's a way that you can kind of encrypt information into other information, kind of, to put it simply. So you could have one letter C could equal D, right? That would be a transposition cipher. So maybe the whole alphabet would just be shifted over by one letter, right? So if you can imagine, there's lots of ways that you could create ciphers and hide messages in music. So unlike my normal process of writing music, I use that idea to create a whole album's worth of music, where there's essentially some clues in every song that lead you to a physical treasure worth $10,000. And so it's exciting, and for me to write music that way, but also to kind of create a treasure hunt, because I've always been kind of a closet Indiana Jones fan. I mean, not a closet. I mean, I'm open about it. I tell people I love Indiana Jones. So if I could go on a treasure hunt tomorrow, I would. In fact, I was inspired by Forrest Fenn, who put a treasure, basically embedded a treasure map into a poem that he did in his memoir. And I thought, well, that was worth $2 million. I can't afford to make a $2 million prize, but we can do a $10,000 prize. And I just want to make it fun for people and fun for myself. And if I can't go on a treasure hunt, at least I can start one. So, and you don't have to actually be, a skilled music reader. If you just have the basic knowledge of knowing what the note names are, and if you can read the music, it's actually, all the clues are embedded in the written songs. So, and once that comes out, we're going to try to do more PR on that and kind of get the word out. I think a lot of people don't really even believe it when they first hear it, or they don't quite understand it. They need to hear it like 3 times, 4 times. Yes, there's a $10,000 treasure embedded in the music. And as far as I know, it's the first time it's been done. So I'm kind of happy about that. But I don't know. Yeah, that's that album. And aside from that, some gigs are coming through in the future, including a very interesting and fun one where we get to take the band. Actually, the core members that did the Hindsight album, we're going to be traveling to Qatar and playing a week worth of concerts out there as part of it's kind of a spinoff from the, I used to do these tours. Was kind of, I don't know, do you remember when Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington, they were in Jazz Ambassadors and they played overseas?
Yes.
Yeah, so that kind of started an ambassador program where we would send jazz musicians over to these other countries. And so I got to participate and do that in 2007 and 2008 through Jazz and Lincoln Center, and made some good contacts out there. And one of them actually called me and said, hey, you want to play Qatar for a week? So that's going to be a lot of fun. And, you know, the fact that right now there's so much uncertainty in terms of booking gigs and having things in advance, it's really nice to have some stuff to start to put on the books, you know?
Well, that's really a lot to look forward to. And I hope that you come back and talk to us when you release Cypher. I can't wait to hear the new songs. I'm already excited about what you've recorded in these last few projects, and looking for the future. It's very bright for you, and I'm really happy to know you, and I'm also happy for what's to come.
Thanks, Dawn. Yeah. I will be sure to share as soon as we get some more stuff happening.
Sounds great. Thank you so much for hanging with me today, and break a leg tonight at your show.
And, thank you.
Hopefully I will talk to you sometime in the near future.
Sounds great.
All right, Charlie. Thank you so much.
Yep. Take care.
That was trumpeter Charlie Porter with his tune Hindsight. You also heard from his songs Tipping Point and Going Viral. These are from his album entitled Hindsight. Coming up, I sit down with saxophone player Chris Green. You're in for a real treat here on The Sauce. I'm Dawn Burns. You're listening to The Sauce here on 88.1 WVPE.